It could be relentless, its rays beating down on the earth, killing flowers sometimes, causing them to wither. She had a garden, she knew. They say it was a casual question when in 1859 Emily Dickinson asked a friend, "Are you afraid of the sun?" But those who read her poems closely feel she's posing a question that reverberates throughout her work, the work of her hands, that is, her poems. In Lunacy of Light, Wendy Barker suggests, repeatedly in Dickinson's writing, images of sun dazzle only to abandon, beckon only to burn, while images of darkness, although at times suggesting the awful finality of death, frequently provide quiet refuge from the often frightening and obliterating rays of the sun. In many instances, Emily Dickinson associates the sun and daylight with her Calvinist God, with the expectations of the fathers, with housework and daily duty. In short, the sun's light comes to represent male energy, male power. And yet, even early on, she imagines there must be another kind of light. Barker says, in a poem like Unbroken Forehead, the snow spreads out over a wide landscape, providing a scope for the imagination and the mind not possible under a blindingly bright summer sky, or even a winter sunlight that revealed gashes or conspired to behead flowers. So, in a sense, Emily accomplishes a revolution in locality or place by finding solace, inspiration, and room in the dark or the dark season. And that, in turn, leads to a revolution in vision, to what Emily calls another way to see. What I see not, I better see, till jealous daylight interrupt and mar thy perfectness. That's why it's so marvelous that we meet Emily in silhouette, the interplay of dark and light that is intrinsic to shadow puppetry fascinates Laurie McCants. So much so, she says, she knew she had to have such shadows in her play, Industrious Angels, taking place in a shadowed attic, crammed with chests and drawers, unfolding through puppetry, paper cutting, music, movement, light and dark, and the weaving together of words. As a daughter searches for what it is that ties together her mother, herself, and Emily, the elusive poet. And since words are central in every way, didn't we just hear about Emily's revolution in vision, revolution in locality? How wonderful, then, that this play, Industrious Angels, took shape in a play space, almost literally in Emily's backyard, at a theater festival with a name that actually suggests revolution, named for the 49th hexagram of the I Ching, the ancient Chinese book of changes, where it means revolution and suggests a shedding of skin, a molting, a sloughing off of the old. It is a place where creativity is encouraged, new vision encouraged, and also that sense of making new, making freshly. Sabrina Hamilton is co-founder and artistic director of the Co Festival, for that is its name, in Amherst, Massachusetts, and she has come to work with Laurie McCants as director, lighting designer, and dramaturg for Industrious Angels. Laurie McCants, a co-founder of the Bloomsburg Theater Ensemble, writer, director, and award-winning actor, will present Industrious Angels this week at the Alvina Krauss Theater, BTE's home. And she and Sabrina Hamilton paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about the production. In Laurie's telling, here's how it all began.
In my memory, I'm driving to Amherst thinking, I haven't done my homework, I haven't done my homework, I haven't done my homework. What am I going to make a piece about? Well, at BTE, we make pieces about the places where we live. Well, where am I going? What's the place I am driving to? Amherst, Massachusetts. What do I know about Amherst, Massachusetts? Well, Emily Dickinson lived there. Well, I'm not going to make a piece about Emily Dickinson because that has been done to death. And what do I have to add to that conversation? But I get there, and this marvelous teacher, Michelle Matlock, who was the Cirque du Soleil clown, who had performed her own piece at the Cove Festival, which was called the Mammy Project. And she sensed that I was in something of distress. And she said, go out for a walk. Just go for a walk. So my feet took me to the Emily Dickinson House in Amherst, Massachusetts, which I highly recommend anyone at all interested in history, in women's creativity, in poetry, in beautiful preservation of a historic home. This place is amazing. And I got my topic by visiting that house, because after walking out of the upstairs bedroom where Emily Dickinson, the radical recluse that she was, where Emily had written the close to 1,800 poems that were found hidden away, secretively hidden away after her death. She wrote most of those poems in her bedroom. And I walked out of that bedroom, and there was something about the architecture of the actual house, the actual hallway, maybe a certain slant of light from the hall window. I was struck with a flood of memory, one of them being that my mother read me Emily Dickinson poetry when I was little, and I was actually reading an Emily Dickinson poem to my mother at the moment of her death. That was the link that I needed to explore. Myself, my mother, Emily Dickinson. And that was the beginning of the thought of what my piece would be about.
At that workshop, then, you began to explore what you've just articulated for us. And by the time you left, what did you have?
Oh, we had a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff that has been since discarded. But the initial impulse and the real strong themes of the piece were already present at that point. And I was so lucky that I was at the Co-Festival with Sabrina, who instantly got interested in the possibility of being my collaborator on this as director and as lighting designer, because the piece is all about light and dark. Yeah, shadows and light. That imagery always appears in Emily Dickinson poetry. And as it has turned out, and it didn't necessarily seem that way when I first started working on it, the piece, as it turned out, is very joyous. It's very playful. Michelle, my teacher, had encouraged us to consider our themes in terms of dichotomies, as, you know, something versus something. And the first thing I came up with was solitude versus loneliness. You know, that wouldn't make instantly for a very cheerful piece. I would say that that is still there in the piece, but the choice that Emily Dickinson made to keep writing her poetry despite all kinds of discouragement from others, because her poetry was at that time considered very strange, very eccentric. It still is, actually, but at
ahead
that time,
of its time.
Yeah, it was ahead
certainly.
Of its time. She didn't stop writing. She kept writing. That kind of courage, that kind of perseverance, that kind of belief in herself, that's a joyous thing. I believe that even though we have this received image of Emily Dickinson as this very strange, very weird, maybe really unhappy hermit, recluse, and that horrible old-fashioned word, spinster, I think she led a very happy life. It was a chosen life. She chose her art. She chose her family. She chose her place. She probably had some sort of agoraphobia, but she also had lots of friends that she kept in constant contact with through letters and notes and all kinds of stuff. But I think it was a happy life. And in exploring my mother's life and my life in relationship with hers, my mother was also a writer. She wrote short stories, essays, poems. Most of these were not published in her lifetime. My mother thought of herself as a failed writer. After her death, I found her writings hidden away in chests and drawers. And she was a good writer. And so the whole piece leads up to my sharing one of my mother's stories with the audience. And it's a beautiful story. It is well told. It is crafted in a delightful way. It's a bit of a painful story for her because it's a story about her own childhood in which she realized a painful truth about her own family, really just having to do with the shame of poverty, which always makes me think, why is shame associated with poverty? But it's a great story, and it's a playful story too. There's a lot of wonderful twists and turns in it, and it's delightfully told. So I find in the telling of the story, I am bringing my mother's words to an audience, and it plays well for almost all ages, like 10 years old and up. And then the piece ends with the fact, my realization that I am who I am as a creative woman because of women like Emily Dickinson and my mother who have gone before me.
The difference being, though, your work is not tucked away in chests and drawers. It's on the stage at the Bloomsburg Theater Ensemble.
Now, Sabrina, you're at the Co-Festival, and Laurie's thinking and working these things out. What did you see at that time that made you say, this is going to be special? It's not just another Emily Dickinson piece.
Exactly, which I would not have gone near with a 10-foot pole. I saw that Laurie, you know, she was an English major. She's a master of language and words. But I also saw a real image life in the piece, a way of working with objects, a way of working with space. Some of the great collaborators on the piece, because the piece took several years to make. So she came back to Amherst. We came to Bloomsburg. I remember we raided the entire Bloomsburg theater prop shop. There's a new genre of theater I call theater of stuff. And this is a prime example of theater of stuff. There is more stuff that the audience doesn't, we don't even touch, but it needs to be there on this stage, these wonderful cabinet of curiosities. And early on, one of the main collaborators was Elaine Williams, who's an extraordinary designer, puppeteer, puppet designer, and Laurie was making puppets, and there became this whole language of puppetry in the piece. Laurie, I knew one of her goals was to create a gesture sequence of the piece without bringing the piece to a halt to do a dance number. But there was opportunity for an extraordinary group of people to gather, including Guy Klusevic, the composer, who came to Bloomsburg. We sat in the freezing cold at the Moose, where he could either plug in his electronics or the heater. So we had some choices to make during the course of one cold snap winter rehearsal period. But it takes a village to make a solo show. And Laurie is such, because of her work with the Bloomsburg Theater Ensemble and who she is as an artist, she's a consummate collaborator. And so there was just this kind of stunning dialogue between Elaine and Guy, who are masters in their field, and Laurie, who's a master in hers. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to tag along and sort of conduct a little bit of the process.
More than a little bit. Sabrina not only was my lighting designer and director, also dramaturg, helping me craft the arc and shape of the piece, helping me distill what was the essence, what needed to be there and what didn't need to be there. Guy Klusevic, our musician / composer, he is a world-renowned avant-garde accordionist. He's a fabulous collaborator, but he was a little hesitant about this piece at first. He told me that he wasn't that keen on working with what he called found material, which at that point, early on in the process of creating the piece, the found material that we had were basically Emily Dickinson poems and some of my own family history, some of my mother's writings, some ideas that I wanted to work with, shadow puppetry, just a kind of eclectic pile of found material. And Guy was a little hesitant. He said, I'm not sure I'm the right composer for this. And I said, Guy, you are the right composer. I know you are the right composer. The very next morning, I opened my laptop. This was 8 a.m., I think. The email had been sent at 6 a.m. from Guy saying, I had a brainstorm this morning. What do you think of this? It was Chant for Industrious Angels, which is a gloriously beautiful piece. It is the theme for the play. I emailed right back and said, yes, yes.
And yes.
Yes. And the music started telling me what the piece needed to be. So there are sections of this piece that came about because of the music that Guy
and
wrote.
Are written to. The music is the architecture, so they're really written to it, or the whole staging movement task sequence is done to that music. And a lot of really tight coordination, practically down to the way a singer would plan where they were going to breathe in the music. Lori's essentially doing the same thing when she's speaking, but even when she's not speaking, it's that kind of close interweave right on the stage.
So it is a recorded score that I perform with, recorded beautifully. Lucky for me, Guy has a lot of connections. And we had accumulated, between the two of us, some grant money to help with this. So it's Guy on accordion. It is Todd Reynolds, who is one of the premier violinists in the world. He often plays with the group Bang on a Can. Todd Reynolds is on violin. Isabel Ettenauer, who is based in Vienna, on piano and toy piano. So these are the four musicians who recorded the score in a studio. And even though it is recorded music, I feel the presence of those musicians on the stage with me. There's one part of the piece where I am taking the actual time it takes to do an accordion paper fold of a long piece of paper, draw an outline in my hand, cut it out, and reveal it to the audience. And that's all to this beautiful piece written by Guy, played by these incredible musicians. I think that's The Landscape Listens. I think that's the title of that piece. The audience, they just love the fact that I'm taking the actual time to do that.
There's something really risky about making actual art on stage. It's not just the performing art, but I've done this in a couple of pieces that I worked on. And to see people actually create something on stage, whether it be through paint or paper cutting or whatever it is a particular, that work is not usually done in real time. And this is done in real time. And if it goes wrong, it goes wrong. And there's that kind of liveness that I think the whole piece invokes. So yes, it's recorded music, but the accompanying thing that's happening to it is oh so live.
It's amazing. The audience loves it. And I often get applause when I finally
unfurl
this paper hand chain. Yay, yay. The paper hand chain connects to one of the resonant images throughout the piece, which is the hand. That's partly from the fact that I am doing paper folding, paper cutting, handy work as part of the process of the piece. I wanted that to reflect and honor the work of women's hands. I also do a little bit of sewing in the piece, but also very much inspired by the imagery in both my mother's short story and Emily Dickinson's poems. It's so amazing how often the image of hands appears in, particularly, I think, women's writing. Emily has that line, "I felt my life with both my hands to see if it was there." It's such a beautiful recognition of the physicality of our lives, the making of meaning that artists do in our lives and do for us to help us through our lives.
Then in terms of creating a space, we have a sense, as I remember, of the place where you're working. It is like we are in a room, a small room, a space, but a workspace, right?
A handicraft room.
I call it a workroom / playroom. It evokes, in some regards, the attic room at the top of my own house, where I actually did a lot of work on creating this piece. An imagined workroom playroom that I have in my mind that is filled with all kinds of stuff that I can just pull off of shelves and make things out of.
Including many hands. There are many hands all over the set. I'd be interested to do a ticket giveaway who gets the closest number of hands. But some of them are hidden away and some of them are in full view. And they're in so many different materials. It really, the show is a dance of the hands.
A dance of the hands.
Beautiful. You used the word, and we are looking now at a collage. Tell us how that image of a collage figures in the creation of this piece.
Well, in the early conceptualizing of the piece, I applied for a grant to the Jim Henson Foundation. Bless you, Jim Henson, and bless Jim Henson's descendants, because they have been so incredibly supportive of the experimental puppetry field. New work in puppetry is happening all over the world because of Jim Henson. Now, I didn't get the grant. That's okay. And this often happens when you're putting together a grant application at the early stages of making a piece, you don't really know exactly what you're going to be asking for. You don't even exactly know how to describe the piece. But the discipline required from the grant writing process helps with that. And in addition to writing some words about what I thought I was going to be doing in making this piece, I put together a collage of some of the images that I had already, visual images that I had already started collecting that I thought might have some use or certainly some serve as some inspiration to me in making the piece. There are many visual artists who've been very inspired by Emily Dickinson. Leslie Dills, she's so fabulous. Leslie Dills, primarily a 3D sculptor, and a lot of her sculptures are these gorgeous, beautiful, kind of scary pieces that she's created from Emily Dickinson poetry. Emily Dickinson was not a sweet poet. Emily Dickinson dealt with terror a lot in her poetry. She knew the terror of what it means to be alive, to try to figure out, who am I? Who am I beholden to? What about life frightens me? How do I face that? How do I work through my fears? A lot of her poetry is about that. A lot of them connected with what it means to be a woman in this world. I'm influenced by the fact that women of Emily Dickinson's time did a lot of craft work in order to decorate their homes. A paper cutting, a flower pressing, that kind of thing. So the collage is built upon imagery that I had started to collect already, just in file folders and in boxes. And another female artist is Remedios Varo, who was Spanish-Mexican. She was working in the 20th century. She was considered a surrealist. I saw her paintings when my family took a driving trip from Tulsa, Oklahoma to Acapulco. It was a beautiful trip. And we visited the art museum in Mexico City. I was 16 years old. I saw Remedios Varo's work for the first time. They are all about female creativity. And there are many images that have worked their way kind of subliminally into my piece. She has a lot of images of women opening up chests and drawers and being somewhat intrigued and somewhat frightened by what's contained in the chest or the drawer.
And so there are many chests and drawers of different kinds on this set. And pretty much every time you open one, something special happens. And we've had some help on this. Some of the things, and I won't say what they are, but some of the special effects were actually built for us at the Center for Puppetry Arts down in Atlanta, Georgia, who are specialists in making this extraordinary kind of stage magic that Elaine Williams and Lori have designed. So there's lots of super special commissioned stuff.
Did scary stuff come up for you? It must have when you were creating this.
Oh, yeah.
The dream.
Yeah, there is a dream that I enact, basically, using flashlights and an evening glove and a little crystal ring that has to do with a very vivid dream that I had in my adult life. I know it was about encountering my own fears as a creative woman, that there are pressures in this world to be quiet, to stifle what you have to say, to smother your instincts. And that's what that dream was about. It appeared to me as a beautiful witch rising from the foot of my bed, laughing at me. And I don't know whether this was something that I consciously made happen, but the dream actually has a triumphant ending, which I reveal towards the end of the piece. But it's true terror, and to me, it's very much the same kind of terror that Emily Dickinson faced full frontal in her poetry. you know, those forces both within yourself and in the outer world who tell you no, 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 no. You are silly. You are not worth it. No, just shut up. And she didn't shut up, and I'm not going to.
And your mother, alas, was susceptible.
She was very susceptible to that, yes. I mean, she grew up in the 1930s. She worked her way out of poverty through education. She was very proud of her education, but also very self-doubting. Self-doubting about her own powers as a creative artist, which is why it gives me great delight to present her story to the world. After the performances, I invite the audience up on stage to explore the set because it's intriguing. There are a lot of things that aren't actually revealed in the course of the piece that are there primarily just as emotional
resonance
for me, because it's my world that's up on that stage. It's my little world.
Your house is practically bare.
Yeah, a lot of things from my own house are on the stage. But we did a performance at Allegheny College in Western Pennsylvania a few years ago. Lots of wonderful visits with classes, all kinds of classes, creative writing, American literature, women's studies, theater classes, of course. And in that milling about of the audience on stage after that performance, which had gone very well, it was a really warm audience, I got a tap on my shoulder and I turned around. It was a tall young man from one of the creative writing classes. And he said, "If I ever write a short story half as good as your mother's, I'll be in heaven." And I just kind of looked up and I said, "Mom, I'm not sure I believe in heaven, but I hope you're up there. And I hope you heard that."
How do you describe it, as a gift to your mother in a way, or a revisioning for her, for you?
Yeah, it's a gift to her. It's a gift to me to be able to feel fully both her pain and her great creative gift, her own gift. It's a gift to the audience. It's sharing with them my love for my mother and also my love for Emily Dickinson and my love for theater, for what theater can do in terms of storytelling, in terms of helping us figure out this muddle that we are in called life. The signposts, the little lights along the way that artists like Emily Dickinson and my mother give to us.
And for so many, the F word is failure. And, you know, once you fail, there are many people who are afraid that they will be shut down forever. So nothing ventured, nothing gained. Well, then indeed. So I think there's something about the legacy of your mother and Emily giving you the courage to not just create, but to show and to bring it to the world. And that's what you're giving back to your mother, is you're bringing her work to the world as well.
In our 2019 lives, questions about women and all these sorts of issues are with us every day. What does this piece have to contribute to this conversation, and why do we need to see this?
I think there's something about women giving themselves permission to make work and to show it. But it's even stronger than that. There's a wonderful feminist theater company called Split Britches, who are known. And one of the things I love that they said is, "Don't wait to be asked to dance. Create the ball." And this is a prime example of that. And I think it also shows us where we have the potential to go on this trajectory from Emily's sort of reclusive life with some, you know, I have a pet theory that I think that maybe she had epilepsy, which is why she was hidden away. But there are many, many different schools of thought on this, to Laurie's mother's situation, to Laurie's own situation. And the rest is for the younger people in the audience to see where they want to take it. But to remember that they stand on the shoulders and experiences of those who came before, and you honor them by saying yes.
Sabrina, I wanted to go back to light. You live and work in and around Amherst, where Emily Dickinson was. And if climate change hasn't intruded too much, you're familiar with the light in the Pioneer Valley in that area. How does that affect you personally? And then is there anything of that, even though we don't know necessarily where we are, I suppose, in the play, do we? We're not in a place.
It's an imagined place.
Did that light have an impact on the way this show looks?
It does, because right now there is a pressure to turn everything into LED lights. All the theaters are getting grants for that. They're throwing away a lot of these traditional theatrical light sources, which are tungsten-based. There's even a Save Tungsten campaign that started in Europe because they're really trying to outlaw these kind of light bulbs. You notice they're no longer making 100-watt incandescent light bulbs. There is a kind of light that is a kind of human light that comes from these that is based in some ways on the color temperature of a candle. Our relationship to candles, to fire, to the sun, to the natural world, and the world that provides light in that sense is getting rendered asunder right now. And this show can happen not in a theater. It can happen with little lamps that Laurie bends and twists and maneuvers and turns on and off in the show. Of course, when we're in a theater, we add some stuff. But I keep trying to add more color and gel because I should do more. And in rehearsal, I just pull it away and pull it away and pull it away and turn off lights more and more. Just simpler, simpler, simpler. Because there's a kind of humanity to this kind of light. There's a kind of breath in it, I think, that is core to Laurie's performance and is core to the music, and hopefully it's core to all the visual aspects of the piece as well. So this is the light that matches the hand.
There is a poem that I share in the play. I share a couple of the well-known poems, but also some of the lesser-known poems. And this one does have to do, I think, with the light in Amherst. She says, "I send two sunsets. Day and I in competition ran. I finished two and several stars while he was making one. His own was ampler. But, as I was saying to a friend, mine is the more convenient to carry in the hand." My interpretation of this poem is that she's talking about poems. I send two sunsets. Those are the poems that she's probably put in a basket. She lowered a basket on a rope from her bedroom window. They often had poems in for the neighborhood children or nearby friends. I send two sunsets. Those are two poems. Day and I in competition ran. Day, by day, she means God. Or the sun, sunrise, sunset. Well, I finished two and several stars. The stars are the unfinished poems. They're not quite ready. While he was making one, he's only made one day. Okay. His own was ampler. Yes, day is pretty big. But as I was saying to a friend, mine is the more convenient to carry in the hand. A little poem on a little piece of paper, which contains, well, as she says, firmaments. She was very proud of her work. She knew she was good. She's daring to compare herself to God right there.
Laurie McCants, a co-founder of the Bloomsburg Theatre Ensemble, writer, director, and award-winning actor, and Sabrina Hamilton, co-founder and artistic director of the Coe Festival in Amherst, Massachusetts. She is director, lighting designer, and dramaturg for Industrious Angels, a one-woman piece created and performed by Laurie McCants. The show will be presented this week, January 31st through February 3rd, at the Alvina Krauss Theater, 226 Center Street in downtown Bloomsburg. The shows will be Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 7:30 p.m., with a Sunday matinee at 3. Industrious Angels by Laurie McCants, directed by Sabrina Hamilton, January 31st through February 3rd at the Alvina Krauss Theater, 226 Center Street in Bloomsburg, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, January 31st, February 1st, and February 2nd at 7:30 p.m., the Sunday matinee, February 3rd, 3 p.m. For more information, on the web, bte.org, bte.org.